the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
So this is Matthew chapter 5 on page 916, and we'll read from verse 13 of that passage. Okay, so verse 13 says this: "You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house." And here comes the final verse that we've not looked at yet. "In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." And as I say, over the last few weeks, we've been looking at this passage in depth. We've now reached the last two installments of it. And this morning, we're looking at the first part of this verse. Well, we'll have a look at the whole verse, really, because it doesn't make any sense unless you look at it all. But the ending of it, Derek will be focusing on to conclude the series next week. So we'll be talking in this part of the passage about being a lamp. And you remember last week we said the image here is just a small, common clay lamp. The sort that you find millions of examples of in archaeology all over the Mediterranean and the Near Eastern area. Everybody used one of those. It was a small, humble thing. If it smashed on the floor, it didn't matter because you could buy another one for a few pennies or even make one yourself. And out of all of that, we started talking about what does it mean when it says we are lamps, and what's this light thing that's supposed to be in us? And without rehashing the whole of last week, we came to a definition that light is, looking at the way that the word light is used through the Old Testament and the New Testament, light stands for everything that God can do for us that we can't do for ourselves. His guidance, his rescue, his help, his inspiration, his wisdom, all sorts of things light stands for. And then we came to a definition of what being a lamp actually means as well. And we said, okay, if we are light bearers, if we are agents of conveying to other people everything that God can do for us that we can't do for ourselves, what does that say about us? Being a lamp is communicating not just a message, but everything that can make the reality of Jesus apparent to other human beings. You can have your message absolutely straight and yet live in such a way that your words aren't heard because your life is shrieking too loudly. So it's everything you say and do, everything that you are for the sake of Christ. And we said, looking at the passage last week, there are four things that stick out. First of all, it talks about a lamp. Previously, it was speaking about a city on a hill. And that's all of us together, lots of lights massed together, making a massive impact on the darkness. The awesome power of what the church can do when we work together on stuff. But now we're isolated, we're on our own. So we are a city on a hill, but I am a light in the darkness. And there'll be times when you're on your own, so we're made to be individual, we said. Then we looked at another phrase, and we said, nobody puts a lamp like this under a bucket. And so we're made to be used, we're made to shine, not to be stuck away in the cupboard somewhere. We're also made to be obvious. Instead of putting it under a bucket, you put it on a stand where everybody can see it. And then it does good to everybody in the house. So it's made to be effective as well. And those things are true of a Christian. We're made to be individual, used, obvious, and effective. And if that's the case, we said last week, if we're made to be individual, you can't just be a crowd Christian who goes to festivals and big events, who switches his evangelicalism on when the band strikes up. It's got to be something that's a 24/7 job. You're a Christian all the time, even when you're on your own. And if we're made to be used, you can't be a closet Christian, keeping it to yourself and not letting anybody know about it. If we're made to be obvious, you can't be a concealed Christian. People will notice whether you want them to or not. They'll see what your life is all about. So intentionally reflect Jesus. Shine the way you're supposed to. Otherwise, it won't work. People will see it anyway. And you can't be a colorless Christian. You're made to be effective. to make a difference on the world out there. You can't be 90% colourless, fading in with the background, with just that little bit of the pink tie in that picture, the fact that you're a Christian being noticed as one of the weird things about you. No, your whole life has got to be out there making a difference in the world, because that's what it means to be a lamp in the darkness. Well, okay, that was last week. Now let's look at the passage we've got for this week. This is a verse, and it says in the version that we have it in here, in the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good deeds, it says in our passage here, and glorify your Father which is in heaven. In other words, it falls into three bits, really. First of all, let your light shine in such a way that. That's the first point. Then second, they see your good works. And then third, the third thing we've got to look at this morning, third bit of it, press the right button, is and they glorify your Father. Now, you might look at that and think, that's a weird way to divide it up. Let your light shine in such a way that. That's a weird point to make, isn't it? And the first thing I want you to know this morning is you must let your light shine in such a way that. Yes. Mm-hmm. Surely it's more natural to say, let your light shine in, and then in such a way that they see your good works, and then, and glorify your Father. But actually, the whole point of that first bit is the in such a way that. Do you see how the first word comes in there in Greek? Houtos lampsato. Thus, let shine your light. In other words, it's not just saying, let your light shine, people, let your light shine. It's saying, let your light shine in a particular way. Because your light is going to shine whether you want it to or not. Remember what we said? You're going to be obvious. They're going to see it. The question is, what impact will it make when you let the light shine out of your life? And Jesus is saying here, let your light shine in such a way that certain things happen. And that word is so important, he's put it right up the front. This is the way in which I want you to let your light shine. Now, what exactly then does he mean by that? Well, as I said, the lamp is a very common object. You'll find bits and pieces of lamps following basically the same design all over the Near East. And some of them have bigger wicks holes, and some of them have bigger oil filling holes. Some of them are a slightly different shape. And they all reflect the light, the same light, in a slightly different way. Some are better than others, and that's why those designs are found more commonly, because loads of people use them. Other designs let out very little light. And Jesus is saying here, let your light shine so that certain things happen. What he says should happen is this: they will see your good works and glorify your Father. That's what should happen. And you might think, is it possible for a Christian to let his or her light shine in any other way? And the answer is yes. There are lots of ways that you can let your light shine in a way that isn't helpful. You can let your light shine, for instance, in such a way that other people despair. Oh, he's so good. She's so saintly. I could never be like that. There's no way I could be a Christian. Aren't they amazing? And they put you on a pedestal and you say, oh, shucks, that's not really that one. Oh, they're humble too. And the way you present yourself just makes everybody else despair. I used to get really fed up when I was a school chaplain at the way that the headmaster would frequently say in head of house meetings when we were discussing some devious decision that had to be taken, well, the chaplain will no doubt say to us that that's not the Christian thing to do, but we have to live in the real world, don't we? And he had the idea, Christians are up here, the rest of us are down there. And I'm not sure I ever managed to dispel that impression for him, so maybe my light wasn't shining all that well. So you can shine your light in such a way that people despair. You can shine your light in such a way that people feel cynical. If you're not that good at projecting the saintly bit, they'll look at you, we know what you're really doing it for. Yeah, taking soup and sandwiches to half-drunken girls late at night. Oh, please, we know what's going on here. It's a way of chatting up girls, isn't it? And you can take anything that's good to do. I'm not implying anything, guys. Please don't look at me like that. I think Sam and David are going to have a word with me after this service, but never mind. You can take anything, as honourable as it may be, and you can make it grounds for cynicism. And you can let your light shine in a way that's open to criticism. And sadly, that's happening all over the world at the moment, isn't it? The hostility of the last 10 years, the new atheism that's made Christians much more critically looked at in our culture than ever before, has led to all sorts of cynicism about why they really do it. I remember growing up in the 60s, lots of people didn't believe in Jesus, but there was still a respect for Christianity. And if you said to somebody on a bus or a train, I'm a Christian, actually, you got this kind of embarrassed response of, oh, that must be very fulfilling. How very good for you. And it was difficult sort of showing people, look, I'm just a normal person. All right, okay, I'm not some sort of super saint. But they got the impression that Christians were to be respected. And you get the impression, sort of, hang on, get out of my way. There may be children and orphans and old ladies to help across roads. I'm Mr. Super Christian. Get me, you know. And, wow, there he goes, Mr. Evangelion Man, with his cape and his underwear outside his pants. You know, and it was you were on a pedestal. And I think the hostility we're seeing at the moment is kind of a reaction to that. Cynicism. So you can shine your light in that way too. You can also shine your light in such a way that people feel patronized or judged, so that you're doing good things to them, but they're getting it in such a way delivered to them that they feel that you're setting yourself a step above them. Sadly, in the 19th century, there were all kinds of great initiatives that went on, and some of them were performed by society ladies and people with lots of money and so on and so forth, in such a way that although their motives were great and their motivation was completely Christian, they let their light shine in such a way that they came across as Lady Bountiful, visiting the paupers for 5 minutes. And people started seeing Christians as kind of socially above them in some kind of a way. That's not a good way to do it either. But I suppose the most common way we can let our light shine badly is that we get the credit for what we do. You know, so we do something. People say, that's brilliant, that's great. Why did you do that? I remember when my daughter was doing some sociological research at the school where I was a chaplain. She followed 1 year around for a week. And they were a year with whom I had a lot to do. And she asked them once or twice, so how do you get on with the chaplain? It was kind of, oh, he's great. He does so much for us. We don't know why he's doing all these things for us. I was thinking, well, you hear about it in chapel twice a week. Make the point. But I was failing because they were seeing me as Mr. Nice Guy rather than seeing Jesus behind me. I've got one little kid in school at the moment that follows me, sir, you're the best. If he uses that phrase once a week, it's 5 times a week. I keep saying, no, Jan, I'm not the best. Jesus says, yeah, I know, but you're pretty good. And it's so easy, isn't it, just to, well, shucks, you know, I just did what anybody would do, you know. We all help one another, don't we? I mean, it'd be a sad world if we couldn't do something nice for one another from time to time. And Jesus doesn't get the credit. Because Jesus says, I want you to let your light shine in such a way that people see your good works down here and they glorify him up there, your Father in heaven. I want the works to be done on earth, but the credit to go to heaven. That can be a hard thing to pull off sometimes, can't it? Because every time you do something nice for people and they say, oh, that was really nice, thank you, you can't say, it's because of Jesus, you know. You get a reputation as a Bible basher in about 37 seconds, won't you? So you have to find subtle ways of doing it and letting people know that this is not you, this is him. And the only way you can do that really is if your life is so full of him that they make that connection for themselves without you really having to say too much about it. So that's the challenge, says Jesus. Let your light shine in just that kind of way. Okay, let's move on to the second bit of it then. So that they might see your good works. On this bit of the verse too, I want to focus on one little part of it, one word, and that's the word good. Why that one? Well, because at the moment you'll see lots of t-shirts a bit like this going around. Kalos Kai Agathos. And you might think, what? 3 Greek words, and it means good, and good in a different way. What's it talking about? Well, of course, it comes from a movie. About 6 years ago, there was a movie called Eat, Pray, Love, which was based on a story about her own experience as a kind of inspirational self-help book written by the author Elizabeth Gilbert. And she talked about how she had felt a great lack in her own life, and so she'd done what she must do to get that gap filled, which was basically divorce your husband and go off on your own. And the first part of the book is about talking about how she managed to get rid of him and get a decent divorce settlement, which she implies came through prayer to the universe, and he finally signed the deal and she had enough money to go off and spend this year doing what she wanted to do. Actually, she was very wise because she signed a deal with a publisher first, so that whatever spiritual enlightenment she found out in the book was already going to be commercially viable for her. I hope I don't sound too cynical, but I think the mask is slipping. Anyhow, she went off for a year and she decided there were 3 places she wanted to go to, all starting with an I. There was Italy, there was India, and there was Indonesia. And that's why Eat, Pray, Love, because in Italy, for 4 months, she learned about how to eat food. in India for 4 months, sitting cross-legged in an ashram. She found out how to pray. And in Indonesia, this is where the happy ending comes in, she found the person who was far superior to the husband she had chucked, and she set up a home with him. And the book has sold a lot of copies. It was for 53 weeks, I think, top of the New York Times bestseller seller list. I'm going the wrong direction. That's not a good thing to do. Come on. That's the right direction. And she said in the book, this thing which has inspired the T-shirt and which has become the most famous quotation from the book, "I wanted what the Greeks called kalos kai agathos, the singular balance of the good and the beautiful." And it's true, the Greek philosophers used to talk about the balanced good life. What's the good life? Well, it's a balance of two things. First, you have to be kalos, and then you have to be agathos, the good and the beautiful. But both words actually mean good. So getting the good life in balance means having the two things equal in the scales. You have to be kalos. Now, kalos, well, let's start with agathos. Because they're equally important, and agathos and kalos are both used in the New Testament exactly 101 times. That's interesting, isn't it? 101 uses of agathos, 101 uses of kalos. Anyway, agathos really means good in the sense of ethically correct. It's the sort of thing that your brain responds to. You see somebody doing something. Was that a good thing? Was it a bad thing to do? No, that was a good thing. You work it out with your brain. That is good. So it's a pretty colourless word in some ways, although it's used a lot in the Bible, because it's important that what we do is good in that ethically correct sense. Then there's kalos, and that's used 101 times too. And the word kalos means good in the sense that you would use it if, for example, you were looking at the goal that Rudy Gusted scored for on Match of the Day last night, and said, "That is good!" And what you mean by that is, that's attractive. That warms my heart. That draws me towards it. It's an emotional word, not a logical, rational word. And the sort of thing you say when you stand in front of a great painting, "That's so good. It's just incredible." And that's the kind of word that Jesus uses. The things we do are not just supposed to be ethically correct and just and right. I help old ladies across the road. I cut the grass for my next door neighbor. Yes, I do these things because I am a pillar of the community and I believe it's right to do, and shucks, it's my duty. It's not that way. We don't do it out of a sense of duty and obligation. We do it out of an emotional sense that I want to make the world a better place. I want to make these people's lives rich. I want everybody to have a better experience of living. And kalos is the kind of beautiful works, that's a better way of describing it, than just good works would be. And so Jesus says, let people see, coming out of your life, all kinds of beautiful works. Agathos is just ethical. Kalos is beautiful. So that's the way that the best evangelists, the most powerful communicators of Jesus, have always been. This is Henry Clay Trumbull. I almost talked about him last week. I didn't, and people were saying in the interval, we saw a man on a slide for about a nanosecond who had a long beard. What was it? Oh, I think they were more interested in the beard than anything. But anyway, Henry Clay Trumbull was a Civil War chaplain in the American Civil War in the 19th century. So a lot of people die very suddenly, very brutally. And as a result, he became convinced there was nothing more important than getting across the Christian message to other people who needed it. And he spent his life, he was renowned as somebody who could connect with ordinary people and make Christianity make sense to them. And he preached lots of sermons. He wrote loads of books, some of which you'll still find around the place. And he said, you know, for all the sermons I've preached and the books I've written, nothing, I'm convinced, is so effective as just sitting down with one other person and chatting to them. So you may not be an author, you may not be a preacher, you may not be any of that stuff, but you can be more powerful for Jesus Christ just through the good things, the beautiful works that you pour into other people's lives, pointing them to your Father which is in heaven. And there's a great story about Trumbull which I like, and this is the one I nearly told last week, about how one day he was getting the train back from New York Central Station to his home in Hartford, Connecticut, and the only seat left on the crowded train was directly opposite a young man who was disgustingly and obstreperously drunk. and kept on dipping into his bag and picking out the largest litre-sized bottle of whiskey he could have bought, and taking swigs from it and offering it round to the ladies in the car. No, thank you. And you could see the atmosphere of frowning and opprobrium and censure in the carriage. Nobody wanted to be with the guy, and he didn't care because he was half drunk and stuffed a lot of them anyway. And so eventually, belligerently, he held out the bottle to Trumbull and said, yeah, have a drink with me. And Trumbull said, no, thank you very much, I don't actually drink. You know, I suppose you think I'm pretty awful too, don't you? And Trumbull came out with an absolutely beautiful line. He said, I think you're a very generous fellow. That just broke the guy. He just couldn't believe it. And they started talking about his life. Trumbull went on to say, but I don't think your drinking is the best thing about you. And the guy said, you know what, I don't think that either. And by the time the train had reached Hartford, that young guy had gone off to see his mother for the first time in years to say sorry, to find a church where he could learn more about Jesus, and to turn his life right around. Beautiful works. Just connecting with people where they are and showing the love and the grace and the mercy of Christ to them. What do beautiful works look like? Well, I'm no expert on aesthetics. There are three things that stick out to me when I look at something and say that's beautiful. First of all is creativity. Beautiful works involve being creative. They don't involve just doing whatever everybody else is doing. Oh, they're getting married, I suppose we better send them a card. It's not that kind of thing. It's doing stuff that you wouldn't expect. That just brings the jolt of surprise and, wow, they really care, into other people's lives. Creativity. When you look at Shakespeare, for instance, and the way in which he's able to take bare, basic stories about European romances or Roman history and turn them into As You Like It or Julius Caesar, that's an incredible jump of creativity, creating something that just wasn't there to start with. Or the music of Mozart. If you've ever seen that great film by Peter Schaffer, Amadeus, about the life of Mozart, it's told by a composer, Salieri, who's as great, as eminent as Mozart is, who despises in some ways this young upstart from the streets of Salzburg, and yet as he looks at what he's doing, despite the fact he loathes his lifestyle, he can't stand the language he uses, nonetheless he recognises that in that guy's imagination, he's hearing sounds, he's coming together with ideas, he's putting things together brilliantly that Salieri, as one of the most eminent musicians of Europe, cannot and never will be able to achieve. And he recognises a creativity there which goes beyond anything he can do. And all great art is like that, isn't it? It's all about creativity. How can you creatively engage in the lives of others to make their lives the way they ought to be? You can even do it in the lives of other Christians. Hebrews chapter 10 says, let's consider one another and work out how we can instigate one another to do beautiful works. Same word, kalos, beautiful works. So how can I stimulate my brothers and sisters to be creative as well? And working creatively is what Christians have always been good at. Look back at the history of the 19th century. Who was it that got stuck in with the lepers, with the prisoners, with the climbing children, with the people who were going down the mines, with the prostitutes on the streets, with the orphans that had nowhere to go? It was the Christians all over the place, and they built a reputation for the work they did, which was fantastic because it brought two things together. First, a faithfulness to God, which just loved other people, and second, a creativity that went into places that nobody else would think about going. Beautiful works are creative. Second thing about beauty, when you see beauty in a work of art, is it's about care. You have to spend time on it. Make it look good. You don't build at the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul or the Taj Mahal in one evening. You spend a lot of time planning and building and putting the thing together. And in the same way, sometimes other people's lives will take patience. They'll take involvement. We can't just dab on a bit of grace and then hurry on to the next customer. It's not like Lucy in the Snoopy cartoons. You know, the doctor is in 5 cents. We don't do it like that. We just give ourselves away and we build things with care and attention into other people's lives. And all great artists are like that. Rembrandt's picture of the prodigal son coming home, for instance, looks so simple. And yet when you get into the depths of that picture, it's immense. We once had a guy called Johnny Baker bring a team here and do an alternative Sunday evening for us, which was just based on this picture. And we had an hour and a half of the most intense, rich worship just based on things, details out of that picture, because Rembrandt worked and worked and worked at it and produced something fantastic. Real beautiful works have stickability. They're put together with care. And that means that they also involve cost. If we're going to live that sort of life, it's going to cost us. We can't be like everybody else because our objectives, our priorities are elsewhere. If you look at the way that the Sistine Chapel ceiling, for instance, was painted by Michelangelo in just 4 years, it was a job that drove him almost demented. He had to build a special platform. He was standing upright, but not quite upright, painting a little bit above him, and he couldn't see the whole spread of the work he was doing. He just couldn't go down to the ground very often and look at the whole thing. He just had to trust he was getting it right. It was a horrible job, and he wrote about it. My stomach squashed under my chin, my beard's pointing at heaven, my brain's crushed in a casket, my breast twists like a harpy's, my brush above me all the time dribbles paint so my face makes a fine floor for droppings. Well, I get that kind of impression every time I try to paint the ceiling, but, you know, he was a great painter. And he still went through paying that kind of cost because that's what art is worth. I've had a bad week in terms of health, but one of the things that's cheered up is the fact that I spent it in the company of another painter. This is my granddaughter, Amelie. She and her brother Louis came to our house for a week last Saturday, and we've had an interesting week with them. We really have. As soon as they arrived, Amelie, who's keen on painting, went upstairs, and she and her brother put a notice on there: Amelie's studio, keep out. And you can see the dire threats that they've made in small letters to those who dare to step in. And it wasn't very long before out of the studio started coming all sorts of work of art. And they are now proliferating all over that bedroom door. They've gone, and you can't see from there, but they're all different prices. And that one, yeah. One of them is £3 million. I won't tell you how much which one that is, but I remember the one on the right there, the colourful one, that's £5,000 because they took a lot of time and care over that. That must have taken at least 20 minutes to finish. And their idea is they'll get a bucket of money and they'll give they'll get two buckets of money and they'll give one bucket to Granny and one to Grandad. So that part of the plan sounds fine to me. And if anybody would like a private viewing after the service, then I can accommodate you. But you don't really want to, do you? Because they're dashed off. They might look good to children, but there's no real cost involved. And I know how it is with grandchildren. Look, Grandad, I've done it. I've spent 2 minutes on this one. Isn't it wonderful? Yes, darling, it's great. I know later on when they're doing GCSE coursework or something like that, they'll really work at their art. But now it's so simple. And this is the thing. If we're going to make a difference in people's lives, it brings beauty into their lives, beautiful works, they're going to cost us. We're going to pay. What might you be needing for this? Well, Derek received, I think recently, from a member at Belmont, and I've got no idea who it is, a piece of paper on which they had thought out some of the things that might need to happen in their life if they were going to be better signposts for Jesus Christ, bringing the message about Jesus to other people. And it's things like this: a living relationship with Jesus from which comes both a desire to share and something to share. Ask yourself the question, is my relationship with him too empty for me to live this kind of life? Second, security in Jesus, not fear of what others think. Could I be doing better if my fear of others was not too overpowering? Genuine love for others with a gentle listening ear. Is my care for other people sufficient? Do I need to pray for God to break my heart for other people? An understanding of our faith in answer to the questions of those in my culture. Do I know enough? Am I equipped enough to serve God in the way that I ought to be doing? And finally, an acceptance of the biblical push to share my faith. Do I have a problem because I've never really accepted I'm supposed to be a light in the darkness? I'm supposed to be obvious. I'm supposed to be effective. Do I have a problem in accepting that? Do I just want to mingle with the crowd, take off my uniform, be a normal person? And when you wrestle with all of those things, you're on the way to producing the beautiful works that start those conversations that David and Sam were talking about, where people say, why do you do this? And you can start talking about Jesus. So we've got the third bit left, and only a couple of minutes to do that, but that's fine because Derek's going to talk about this next week. Let me just finish this talk by giving you one final word to look at, and that's this word, that they should glorify the Father of you in the heavens. What does that mean? Well, Derek, as I say, we'll talk about that next week. But I think many of us read this verse in a kind of romantic sort of a way, and we get a picture in our mind's eye which is kind of like this. There's the old lady in the grocer's at the checkout, fumbling, oh dear, I don't think I've got quite enough pennies. And you say, stand back, this is a case for Evangelii Man. And so you stride, pushing your cape out of the way, you stride to the chicken and say, here you are, old lady, here's the 2p you need. And she says, oh, wonderful. Why did you do that, Evangelii Man? You say, because of Jesus. Oh, yes. And so she goes away saying, isn't Jesus wonderful? Isn't God amazing? Praise God. And the shopkeeper saying, yes, I must go to my local Bible study. Doesn't happen like that very often, does it, really? So what are we talking about when we say that they will glorify God? Well, that word glory is an interesting one because it comes from the old Hebrew word kavod, which means heavy. And to give glory to somebody is to give weight to them. We use the same picture in English a little bit too, don't we? Use sentences, for instance, like this. The counsel for the prosecution has produced some weighty arguments. You mean some arguments you can't avoid? They're important. You've got to listen to them. Or, I don't think you understand the gravity of this situation. Gravity is another word for weight, for heaviness. A recommendation from your father would carry great weight. Weight means importance. They'd sit up, oh, his father's recommending it. Must be right then. And you pay attention to something that's heavy. When the exam is marked, equal weight will be given to accuracy, originality, and style. We don't use it very often in English, but we do sometimes. We say that when something has weight, it means you're looking at it saying, whoa, I need to pay some attention to this. This is impinging on my life more than I thought it would. And so to glorify God is to give him weight. Not to say, you know, Lord, you need to go to Weight Watchers. But just to say, wow, he was almost light weightless in my life. He meant nothing to me. And now suddenly the weight is growing. And I see him as somebody who needs to be paid attention to. Somebody I need to think about. Somebody I need to tangle with. And I think that's what lies behind this whole thing. It's not that everybody's going to drop to their knees in the bus queue and praise Jesus the moment you save a stray kitten. It's not that way. But what you do, the way you live, the contacts you make, the choices you make will bring more and more weight to the idea of God in their mind. And so this is what we've got to do. Let your light shine in such a way that they see your beautiful works and your Father gains more weight in their life as a result, to the point where you're able to tell them the story and they're able to see Jesus as he really is. That's what we've got to do. Let's go out there and sing the story.